CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. A fire in Cuba at a port, Matanzas. The fire is spectacular from the remains of a fuel storage terminal. This begins the story of the decline and fall of the Cuban dictatorship for more than six decades. Not yet, but begins. Mary Anastasia O'Grady introduces me to this spectacular fire. She writes the America's column and America's editor for the Wall Street Journal editorial board. Mary, the claim is a lightning strike, but that lightning strike has visited upon the people of Cuba more of the desperation of electricity that I've been reading about. I hear there are brownouts, and the reason I heard this is because the access to drinking water and agricultural water requires electricity to work the pumps. What is the state of this burning fuel depot? Does this damage the electricity grid? Good evening to you, Mary.
Well, good evening, John. You know, in my column, I referred to it as perhaps the funeral pyre of the Cuban Revolution, because it really does seem like a coup de grace of an economy that has been collapsing for years. And as you mentioned, you know, they say that it was a lightning strike that hit the Matanzas super tanker port terminal. But that may be true. I mean, there's other speculation that there were other causes, but what it shows is that the facility was not, did not have any kind of modern protections against this kind of act of God, no good maintenance and so forth. And this is maybe the most important, but certainly one of the most important fuel storage terminals on the island. It has eight huge tanks, and three of them actually collapsed from the heat of the fire and the intensity of the fire. And the fourth was actually burning, but I think did not collapse. And these fuel storage terminals provide the fuel necessary to run electricity generation plants in key populated areas. And as you point out, they were already having brownouts and blackouts in lots of places. And that's partly because, you know, since they don't pump their own oil, they need to import it and then put it in these huge tanks. And, you know, it's been harder to come by because they're poor. They don't really export anything to speak of anymore except for human beings. And that means they don't have the hard currency to buy the fuel that they need to run the electricity. And they're very much dependent on sort of charity from Venezuela. And now Mexico is more looking kindly on the dictatorship under López Obrador. So, you know, they're really a basket case in so many different ways. And the fire seems, as I say, like kind of a coup de grace. On top of everything else, it seems, you know, quite significant because it's a huge breakdown in electricity, which you say, as you say, you know, provides for pumping water, for electricity, you know, for refrigeration. I mean, you know, you can't have even a 20th century economy, forget about a 21st century economy, without electricity. And that's basically where they're at.
The man who is said to be the president of the Executive Council and the head of the Communist Party in Cuba is in charge of the island, born 1960. And the question raised here is, how's he doing? He's the first secretary of the party. His name is Miguel Díaz-Canel. I've talked about him before, but you introduce in your column, Mary, a name I did not know well, General Luis Alberto Rodriguez López Calleja, now departed at the age of 62. Who was he, and how is he part of the failing story of the Cuban dictatorship?
Well, it's a really good question because the so-called president of Cuba, the dictator, is Miguel Díaz-Canel, as you point out. They still call themselves a communist state, but no one believes it, including the people in power. You know, the whole idea of Marxism and Lenin and the utopia that we'd eventually get to, that's kind of been thrown overboard. Everybody has given up on that. And they're now just trying to maintain the power. And the guy who was really the kingmaker behind the scenes was, as you say, this Lopez Calleja, who died at the age of 62 in early July. He had lung cancer, but I think Raul Castro, who was his former father-in-law, so Lopez Calleja was married to Castro's daughter, and they're divorced. But this general had become really the power over the economic power in Cuba, and therefore the de facto boss of the basically what's a mafia state. And he had a company, a conglomerate, that just kept acquiring businesses and controlling something like 70% of the economy by the time he died. It's known by the acronym GAESA. And so Lopez Calleja was incredibly powerful. Díaz-Canel is not respected, was never in the military, is a civilian guy, doesn't have any charisma. People shout insults him in the street all the time, which used to be completely unacceptable in Cuba. So Lopez Calleja was thought to be the person who was calling the shots and might even been the person who was going to rise at some point to the level after Raul Castro died of sort of the dictator. And now that he died, my argument is that Cuba is in a power vacuum because you don't have Lopez Calleja, you don't have a strong leader who's incredibly intelligent and ruthless running the 70% of the economy. You have Díaz-Canel, who is not respected and very weak. So you don't really have, you have the makings of a power struggle inside the system.
And the power struggle, Mary, turns on help from the outside, because clearly the economy, the infrastructure cannot sustain the Cuban people. There have been protests these the last years, and you write in your column they were brutally suppressed. Does that continue? And who is going to lend a hand to this failing economy? Is it Russia? Is it Venezuela? Is it Mexico? Is there enough aid there to prop up the present regime?
Well, you just named three of the big players, Russia, Mexico, and Venezuela. But I have my doubts that there's going to be enough aid there to prop up this regime, because none of those countries are particularly strong in their own right. And then you have this incredible dissatisfaction coming from the population. I mean, with all the repression that they have used since July 11th, 2021, when there was this island-wide uprising, all this repression, and still people continue to go to the streets, not in the same order of magnitude, but they continue to go to the streets, shout insults at the regime. There's a kind of chaos and anarchy settling in over the island, and it's completely predictable, because this isn't about some kind of political ideology. This is about the fact that there's, you know, long queues for food. There's almost no medicine. And I'm talking about things like aspirin. I mean, just, you know, real shortages of ordinary over-the-counter medicines, no electricity, very little running water. Housing is in very poor shape. I mean, every single measure of quality of life is made Cuba into a primitive country. And people are really unhappy about it. And they have two choices. One, to leave. They try to get to Mexico and get across the border. And the other is to try to, you know, rebel against the system. And that's what they're doing. I don't know where this is going. And I keep saying that communism is dead. Communism is no longer something that people believe in. But that doesn't mean that the island is going to freedom. I mean, there's a step in between, which, if you think of Putin's Russia and the kind of gangster organized crime syndicate that runs Russia now, that is a, you know, possibly an outcome that you end up getting in Cuba if you don't have, you know, some way of helping those people who want to kind of try to reestablish some kind of a democracy with institutions and so forth. That's the big risk in Cuba right now.
And Mary, the Biden administration, does it have an opinion of these cataclysms, whether it was a lightning strike or just a failure of electricity? Is there clarity? We have about a minute.
Well, I think the problem with the Biden administration is that it's looking for something that would be orderly. I mean, it's looking in its own interest. It doesn't want a rafting crisis. So I think it's ready to negotiate with the powers that be in Cuba. And I think that's a bad place to start, because you really want to be defending freedom, looking for people who are champions of freedom, and seeing if you can help them or somehow provide the technical assistance. I mean, I'm not asking for U.S. intervention in Cuba, but somehow provide the technical assistance and the outside support that would help the Cubans go in that direction. I'm very skeptical that the Biden administration is interested in that, because there's more risk there. Whereas if they make sort of concessions to the status quo, I think they believe that they can pursue a smoother path to an orderly transition to, I don't know, a gangster government, but it wouldn't be disruptive in terms of a migration crisis, that kind of thing. So I think the Biden administration prefers that outcome. They're pragmatic.
Mary Anastasia O'Grady for the Wall Street Journal editorial board. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor,